And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hey everybody, it's Dean Haglund here in the offices of Rational Improvement, high above the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with your co-host, my Mr. Phil Lernis, ladies and gentlemen, who almost knocked the water on our mixing board.
We almost had.
That would have been the end of the show. All our equipment would have been electrocuted. And that's how the ending
Do you
this.
Remember back in the original Saturday Night Live, the Not Ready for Primetime Players, when they did a parody of the China Syndrome called the Pepsi Syndrome?
Pepsi melted down the
south. Somebody spilled a Pepsi all over the control panel in the nuclear facility. That's what I flashed back to.
That was about as close as it gets.
Syndrome. No, that was my lightning quick reflexes managed to stabilize the drink, and we are coming at you maybe even a few hours earlier than usual if
Look
you get
that.
Me the show.
Yes.
But you might not because you're going to be out late.
I got to run to a benefit for SciFest.
Oh, are we doing this already?
Why not?
What? Oh, wow. Okay,
well,
so we're jumping. No, that's fine. We're jumping ahead to this.
Oh.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Why not talk about live events, Dean Haglund?
I didn't know this would be the live event.
Well, it's a live event for the love of all that is holy.
But nobody... Oh, yes. Well, we talk about it in retrospect, even though I haven't gone there yet because it's going to start in an hour and a half. But at the California Science Center, members and cast members of SciFest, the Science Fiction Theater Festival, will be doing a benefit with members from NASA and JPL. And we're going to be standing right beside the Space Shuttle Endeavor during a whole fun evening of drinking and nerding out, I believe.
This also fits in so beautifully to the revisitation of last week's What We're Reading. You know, we talked about what we've been reading for the first time in quite a while, and usually we just do this every so often.
Right.
But I got farther. I read more of Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief by Lawrence Wright.
Right.
People been watching that HBO thing. But as we talked about, so many better reasons to actually read it if you're interested in getting the full scope of it, both the good, the bad, the so-called ugly, but also to even be able to look at probably, I'm betting, more examples of where Scientology and Dianetics might have helped people.
Right.
But I'm so glad that you segued from live event of the week, and we'll try to seg our way back.
We're going to re-seg our segs. Segue.
And by the way, this episode of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour is brought to you by the Segway.
It is?
No, although I worked on that. The original press releases for that over at Goal in Pasadena back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Military clearances had to be obtained. Anyway, speaking of all of that, military clearances, JPL, everything. Boy, JPL makes an interesting appearance in this Going Clear book. And I wanted to bring this up. Boy, a couple of our listeners are so savvy. When I hinted at this, they immediately, JPL conspiracies for 500, Alex. They were right in there, buzzing in with what this was about. And I can't believe that your friend, our friend, the delightful Jordan Maxwell, never dropped this little nugget when talking about NASA being a Nazi organization and different conspiracy theories. So one of the real big influences on L. Ron Hubbard after his war career, what went on in the war is subject of much debate, depending on whether you believe the official records and his own memoirs, or you believe the church. But afterwards, he came back to Southern California, and he settled in at the home of John Whiteside, known to his friends, so let's consider ourselves his friend, Jack Parsons, who was, as a very young man, the inventor of rocket fuel.
Oh.
So a bigwig at JPL, and he founded at this fabulous mansion that he bought and then subdivided into kind of like a little rooming houses, absolutely. Yeah. The Parsonage. It was the headquarters of the Agape Lodge branch of the Ordo Templo Orientis, disciples of Aleister Crowley and practitioners of black magic.
Oh, now, that I had heard.
L. Ron Hubbard's own son would say that everything that works in Dianetics is black magic. It's from
Aleister Crowley's thing.
And L. Ron Hubbard used to refer to himself as, you know, being very good friends with Crowley, even though he never studied him. Crowley was quick to point out we never met. but when Crowley died, the way was paved, and it immediately became Hubbard's goal to become, with the absence of Crowley, the most powerful magical being in the universe.
Wow.
To bridge. And see, this does not sound... Well, maybe it does to some people sound occulty. Maybe I'm very culty. I missed my calling. Lily always said, I missed my calling. I should have been
a cult leader.
I should have been a cult leader running my home for runaway girls in their late teens and early 30s. So, but his aim was to bridge individual consciousness into direct communication with universal consciousness.
Ooh.
But does this not find its parallel in everything from Buddhism to
yoga to
quantum
mechanics
to the zero point field
right.
to our friends you know Marilyn Schlitz at the Institute of Noetic Science?
Yes, this is all kind of the same thing.
You know, and
so Agape does that too, I suppose.
And you think of, well, now this, what we know of Agape, which is the secret.
Right.
Michael Beckwith, not the same Agape as this.
Oh,
let's make
that
clear.
Okay, good.
But you're right. The secret is that not putting yourself in alignment with universal consciousness. Boy, we are spinning off planet Earth on this one. There's so much to go into here. But I'm just saying, were I
a
conspiracy gambling man... Couldn't I do something kind of interesting with Jack Parsons?
Yeah.
And his whole connection. You know, he lost his clearance to work on a lot of projects. I mean, he was working with, oh my goodness, he was in a relationship with a woman that ended up, I think, becoming the second wife of Hubbard. But Parsons was in a relationship with her first when she was underage. Sarah Northrup.
Oh.
And oh, didn't that get me excited? I was going Northrup.
Northrup,
because his Northrup's father actually bought the parsonage for Parsons. Well, oh my goodness! So it's Northrup from Northrop Grumman,
of the World War II.
Oh my
goodness!
It's spelled differently. That hasn't stopped
you from putting together
or anyone from putting together a conspiracy theory,
right? You tie strings to things and make meanings out of things.
Anyway, so if anyone has anything about that,
yes.
Because, you know, indeed he was investigated, but the whole purpose of investigation was not into his proclivity for the dark arts and the magic.
Right.
It was whether or not he was a communist. There was some belief that he was, and he had to explain that no... You know, the
universal consciousness is not necessarily
and the Church of Aleister Crowley, this is very anti-communism.
Right.
This is the celebration of the individual.
Ah.
You know, and also one would say anti-fascist, but, you know, anyway.
Well,
So isn't that exciting?
That's
so
exciting.
I want to hear more about.
Yes. Well, after I go to this thing, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
About
find
it.
Out. Yeah, drop yeah. Jack Parsons' name like an anvil or anything heavy.
Hey, yes.
And
like it's at an extreme temperature, perhaps.
Oh, you know, he blew himself up though. He was going to be heading out of town. He was still in his 30s. He and his later his wife were going to be going to Mexico in the early 50s, and he. He died of injuries he sustained blowing himself up in the...
Because he had rocket fuel in his car?
He was probably. Working on some new formula in his study or something like that.
As one does. Oh, well.
There could be some conspiracy theories about that. It's very exciting. Hey, I know we've done it before, but why not do it again? It was so much fun. Let's do Live Event of the Week.
Kate.
The Chilpack Hollywood Live Event of the Week.
That's just for those of you who forgot where we were... When I went off-roading there.
Yes, exactly.
Did you do Big and Tall show this last week?
I did. I bet I did. Oh, no, last weekend we had to cancel because of a private event that was unbeknownst to us.
Okay, so it'll be coming up again tonight.
Tonight, exactly. Right. But, instead I had two tours of downtown Los Angeles to give, so that took up a lot of time. But no Big and Tall show last week, but there is one tonight. So come and check it out at The Lash in downtown Los Angeles.
Excellent. Look up The Big and Tall Show on Facebook.
Yes, it's hilarious.
Why not? Really, on Facebook, it's hilarious?
Well, the artwork sometimes is very funny.
Last week, I conducted my first of four sessions of the acting class.
Oh, yes.
That I've started teaching. And,
Mr. Master Thespian.
This was so inspiring. I mean, I cannot begin to tell you. This was quite a get. It was so inspiring that I already committed to doing this again in May, though on a different night. I'll be doing it Tuesdays in May. Anyway... you know, we spent a lot of time talking about fear and powerlessness and vulnerability and
wow. And so this just wasn't get up and read these lines. Okay, that was good. Sit down. You get into the deep and the dark of it.
I would say that it's probably one third. It's one third depth psychology,
mm-hmm.
one third acting class, one third Lee McCloskey. That's what I would say.
Fantastic. That it is. That's very funny.
And one third, because I always give an extra third.
Exactly. You give 133%.
It's one third the Ice Capades. speaking of things that make me feel powerless and fearful. but it was very interesting, and fear seems very much to be on... on the plate for me right now because, you know, I've never dabbled in the horror genre. And I reached out to you this week because, along with journalist Mark Hockley there in the UK, I co-authored a treatment to what would be my first horror film.
Look at you.
Because, again, what's always stopped me, as we know, the origins of Spectres, the movie we made together, was as a scare the pants off you kind of horror film.
Right.
And I just had a hard time seeing how anything to do with ghosts is supposed to be scary
right.
when you're dealing with a film that focuses on a 16-year-old girl who tried to kill herself.
Right.
That's scary.
Yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah.
Not ghosts.
Yeah.
So, the name of this is A Kill or Be Killed.
No.
And a curse is placed on four individuals, and they each have 24 hours to either murder someone or die a slow and agonizing death themselves.
Oh, my gosh.
And suddenly, I thought, okay, now this I might be able to find, you know,
scary.
The idea of what people believe they might need to do in the name of survival.
Right.
That does become scary.
Right, because, yeah.
And people who have read this, ashen is usually the color after they read this treatment.
Wow.
It's that disturbing.
That's fantastic.
And what I like best about it, two little words... Franchise starter. That's what I...
Are we talking a product locomotive that we can hook on to boxcars of sequels, plush games, and video?
And I've got a great way to keep the cost on the sequels down.
Wow.
So anyway, I won't give away much more than that, but it's really fun. Hey, if we have listeners who are involved in the horror genre and want to help out their friend in podcasting, Phil Lernis, with some advice, because immediately, as soon as we sent this to a producer, he was, absolutely, let's do this. We'll meet in 3 weeks. And I suddenly realized, you know, I know of this person, but
right.
I don't know him. I've never worked with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I ought to be using these 3 weeks to get as many people as possible to see this treatment.
Yeah, start a little bitty more.
Or at least to, you know...
Marshal the resources.
Not to marry my first computer match.
Right? Really? Not your first left swipe? That's not who you marry.
So if you've got some other potential matches for me, let me know. Let us know. ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. That's how you can write us.
Yep.
Indeed, a loyal listener wrote us this week, and we'll get to that email in just a moment.
Right.
First, though, Dean Haglund.
Okay.
And maybe you'll find this out at JPL, because JPL always knows everything. That's part of the conspiracy. And we mean the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yep.
Any latest X-Files news?
There is less X-Files news than there was last week, in that we know nothing. Other than the but you told me that they're hiring writers.
Less than we knew last week.
I know.
It's very interesting.
Exactly. Somehow,
if you could see me stroking my beard, you would know that I'm stroking my beard.
In contemplation of how you can know less this week than you knew last week. Again, I haven't...
What are you hiding? You're keeping something.
I'm not keeping anything.
What do Tom and Bruce think is going on?
They think that they're going to tell us a day before we need to shoot, and we'll get the script as we arrive on set, and that like
it's going to be like the Queen Mary one. You are going to relocate in Australia, and as soon as you're going to be up. You're going to have been flying for 12 hours.
Yeah.
You're going to stretch your legs. You're going to go into the bathroom on the flight. There's going to be a knock, and page by page, or a computer disk is going to be slipped under
the door in the bathroom on the plane.
With the script.
Yeah, exactly.
For your episode.
Saying, turn around as soon as you land.
As soon as you land in China, you got to get on another flight.
Yeah, that's exactly how that's going to work. That's how Fox works. Don't kid yourself.
Because for people who don't know, haven't heard this story, you were going off grid. And really, back then, you could.
You could, yeah.
You had time off from the show.
Yeah.
And you went to go do comedy.
As I oft do, in between episodes, I would go do the clubs around North America.
But I heard that on this one, like, you didn't really let anybody know.
Well, I didn't even know really what hotel I was staying at. I mean, I was advertised at the club.
But you picked up, so you were picked up at the airport.
No, I was driving myself. I rented a car in Toledo and went.
So you just found a hotel?
No, I had the address of the hotel that the comedy club had booked, I guess.
Okay.
So they must have, I don't know how they did it. They looked in the newspaper.
But as soon as you got into this room,
yeah,
there was a script delivery and a phone call from Chris Carter.
Yeah. Just like, how did you do that?
About Triangle.
Yeah.
Wow.
About doing Triangle.
That's big fun.
That's big fun.
Hey, I'm very interested in what you are going to have to say about this rather impressive person who left us this past week.
Celebrity deaths.
Stan Freberg.
Yes. 88 years old.
Were you a fan?
Not only was I a fan, I saw him do his life retrospective live at the Magic Castle. He had...
How long ago was this?
This was about 10 years ago.
Oh, because he was still touring over the last couple years.
Yeah, he was. And he toured this show, which was basically... he was working it out at the Magic Castle. He had just met a new woman in his life who encouraged him to get back on stage and get back to his original loves of live performing.
And then they got married and then they toured together.
And they toured
like the Two Funny Freebergs,
yeah,
or whatever was the name.
Absolutely. And it was a really funny show because he played clips of his the Dragon Slayer, Dragnet the Dragon Slayer, you know, that whole thing. He showed his early advertising work. How he got Clayton Moore to dress up as the Lone Ranger and come on set for a cigarette commercial. How he even came to Hollywood. Hilarious story. He lived in Pasadena, and he goes, I'm going to go make it in Hollywood. So he packs a bag lunch, takes the bus, gets off at Hollywood and Highland, looks at where the Stella Adler Theater is,
right,
and then goes up the stairs. There's an agency. They go, hi, I do voices. Oh, yeah, let's hear him. And does some funny voices. They go, hey, wait a sec. And they call Warner Brothers, and he meets Mel Blanc. That day. And they
really?
Go, it's amazing, kid. Did you just get off the bus? And no offense, but, you know, how come we never heard of you? And basically his first day in Hollywood, he was working with Mel Blanc, and he literally just got off the bus. Hilarious story.
Yeah, I mean, he voiced several characters in those now classic Warner Brothers cartoons with Mel Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's amazing. He also did impersonations on Cliffy Stone's radio program in 1943. That was the two things that he was doing, like right away after starting. And that launched a six-decade career.
Yeah.
And I guess really, as you're saying, a seven-decade career because he's been touring... doing kind of a retrospective.
Yeah, at small theaters and things like that. And why wouldn't you want to hear about the stories of, you know, not just the 40s and Mel Blanc and stuff like that, but the hilarious Mad Men type commercials that he was doing in the 60s that were hilarious and retro even then.
So he went on to work on, obviously, lots of radio programs before he started in an early TV show, I think it was 1949, Time for Beanie. And it was created by the Looney Tunes director, Bob Clampett. And it started as a local Los Angeles program, but went nationwide.
Yes, because it was so popular.
And it ran for 5 seasons nationwide. And while working on it, he then began making his satirical comedy records that would target the popular culture of the day.
Yeah.
The first was 1951's John and Marsha, which I remember when when I was in elementary school in the 1970s, like even Dr. Demento would play pieces of this.
Yeah.
It was a parody of soap operas, a rather sharp, biting parody of soap operas.
Yeah.
And it featured a man and woman simply repeating each other's names with exaggerated inflection. The Dragon Slayer one that you were talking about was St. George and the Dragonette.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The album went to number one in 1953. The record went to number one in 1953.
Think of that.
It was record. We're not saying albums. They were
45s.
The short records, yeah. Like singles.
Like singles.
Yeah.
Going to number one.
And it was a riff on Dragnet. And then that became the first track on his genre-spanning 1977 triple LP, 25 years of recorded comedy.
Yeah.
He became a hero to many when he took on, through his own brand of comedy, McCarthyism, with his record Little Blue Riding Hood. And it featured the line, "Only the color has been changed to prevent an investigation." And then on the following year, he did Point of Order, and he lampooned Joe McCarthy's Hunt for Communists in the State Department. The send-up featured a McCarthy-like character interrogating Baba Black Sheep about how many bags of wool he has.
That's pretty good.
But the record company deleted one of the record's best lines, in which the McCarthy character solemnly intones, "I hold in my hand the list of 27 black sheep." It was a direct jab at McCarthy's famous line, "I have here in my hand a list of 205 names," etc.
Right.
He also hit the pop charts with music tracks. Stan Freberg, "Nuttin' for Christmas."
Oh, yeah.
"Banana Boat Song." And a parody of Heartbreak Hotel, which was kind of an Elvis Presley roast.
Yeah.
And Wonderful, Wonderful, a spot-on parody of the Lawrence Welk Show.
That's right. I forgot all about that.
He also, one of my favorites, did Elderly Man River. Not Old Man River.
Elderly Man River.
He had debuted it on his radio show in 57, and it was him, because I really love. I mean, this is always good fodder, even like on Saturday Night Live. You know, they would do this bit, but it's him battling with a censor.
Yeah.
Right?
Can I say this?
From the Citizens Radio Committee, who finds the lyrics of Old Man River offensive to grammarians. "He must know something, but he don't say nothing."
Right.
And they're worried that it might be offensive to the elderly, hence changing the name
to Elderly Man. He might
River.
Know something, but he may not know anything. Right.
As they said, that he enjoyed really a second wave of popularity a couple decades later when Dr. Demento would feature him so prominently. Right. There's a great Rhino Records box set titled The Tip of the Freeberg, the Stan Freeberg collection, that goes from 51 to 98 that people can check out. So anyway, when you pointed out his trip to Pasadena, from Pasadena, which was in 1943, he was 17 years old.
Yeah, think of that.
And I love that their reaction was, "How come we haven't heard of you?"
Yeah, exactly.
I'm 17.
But he didn't look it, and and he literally did just get off the bus. Like, that was his decision one day. I'm going to do this thing. And he did it, did it for, 7 decades.
He was an actor as well. I mean, he was in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Yep.
And he did a voice in, Lady and the Tramp, the classic Disney.
Yeah.
And I bring that up largely so I can share this story about my 8-year-old goddaughter. She's in third grade, and she has her first exclusive boyfriend.
Uh-oh.
And so she was telling me about it, and she was writing to another friend of hers about it, because I tutor her and take care of her one day a week. And then at the end of her writing this letter. You know, it was a great way to teach her grammar and spelling, easier than doing her homework, because this is something that she wants to be able to send. And so we then sent it to her mom to be printed. And then on the way home, she started to get really upset and nervous because she realized, oh, mom might read that. And mom doesn't know about my boyfriend, and mom might not be cool about it. And so anyway, but so I, you know, I said, look, I'll be there with you and I'll make sure your mom is cool. Let's tell her about this. And so anyway, it was great because when she's talking about her boyfriend, her exclusive boyfriend, she's trying to set her mom's mind at ease. And she said, mom, look, it's very Lady and the Tramp. Isn't that cool?
That's adorable.
But, and then she points out, though, but if he tries to push food at me with his nose, I'm not eating it.
I thought that's crossing the line, mister.
I thought that was great.
That's awesome.
Anyway, well, I'm glad that you got to see Freeberg.
Live,
you know, I mean, you know, it was such a big deal. Again, I'm not the hugest animation fan, obviously, but I was a big fan of Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah.
And Freeberg appeared on, you know, Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So it's so great that, you know, so many of the you know, the more cutting edge comedic voices in animation were
still connected to the past like that. Yeah, it was really neat, actually. I really liked that guy.
You know, this weekend was the return of Veep. Show that we may have talked about a little bit last week when we were talking about Julie Bowen, because we were comparing her to classic television comedians and to Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's, who's not only her contemporary, but also has an interestingly similar career. I mean, different and complimentary, I guess, is,
on their trajectories.
The Veep returned, and there was some really sad news, which is this will not be the final season, but it is the final season that creator Armando Iannucci, you know, who's in the loop.
Yeah,
we loved so much that movie, which was of course
start this working,
and that was a big screen adaptation of his TV series The Thick of It in England. But it just the demands of, you know, raising his family in the UK and then producing the show over here, he just doesn't want to do it anymore. So you can understand, but it is sad because that's such a great team, and his voice is
so clear.
And you know, they're replacing it with David Mandel of Curb Your Enthusiasm. So clearly, both someone who knows HBO and obviously someone who does great work,
and
I think would be able to work with Julia very well.
Absolutely. But improv background.
So it's not that necessarily the show won't be good, but boy, you know, I love hearing that guy's voice.
Yeah, exactly. I love all the
work
he does.
And hearing it through these ensembles, and that, you know, because originally, I don't know if you remember this, like when In the Loop came out, well, it might be too British.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
they worried.
Even though there were American actors
in it. James Gandolfini was in it, wasn't he? Yeah. As the general.
And Anna Chlumsky, who then is in this, in Veep, as, you know, as Julia Louis-Dreyfus's right-hand gal. And who would have thought that? My friend, you know, who's CEO of Empire State Gas, our sponsor on Chilpack Hollywood Hour, you know, they're the largest independently owned gas station in the Northeast, and their gasoline products are their petrol, as it's known in the UK. Let's say that is all organically grown.
Yes.
So it's good for the environment. Empire State Gas, from farm to pump, we've got great gas. Their CEO was saying, "Can you imagine if somebody told you 6-7 years ago, Anna Chlumsky, comedy star, wait for it, you would have gone
wow, way off base, you lost it."
And she's so great.
Isn't that amazing?
But anyway, the point is that his voice translated so well here to this set of actors.
Right.
Like you said, it's not British, it's not American, it's his voice, and it's so clear.
Yeah.
No matter what he's working on.
So that's
on.
A drag last year of his stuff.
Disappointment.
Well, we'll see.
Here's a listener email.
Oh, we like those.
Because you know, last week
we answered one.
Well, we sure we did.
Yeah, I bet we did.
We did. But last week we were talking about, among other things, we were talking about several movies that we'd seen.
Yes.
And one of the movies we talked about was a movie that opened this last weekend, or Friday, called Clouds of Sils Maria, from Oliver Assayas, a French filmmaker, starring Juliette Binoche, which is really a must see, just an amazing film. And we got an email from Agent Summer that I have conveniently
Misplaced.
Here it is.
There it is.
Things are only missing for so long. I mean, I have organization on our show tablet. Hello, Dean and Phil. Just finished listening to your latest podcast, number 412.
Hey.
In the course of your conversation,
yes,
Phil mentioned The Clouds of Sils Maria, citing it as a significant female-driven movie, and the importance of supporting such movies. That was the big thing.
Yes.
Especially, look, not just box office, but in this town.
People need to do this.
But the importance of supporting such movies. Given the huge number of films over the years, it's hard to know where to even begin.
Uh-huh.
Do the two of you have some suggestions of other female-driven movies that are worth viewing and supporting?
Wow.
Now, I was going through, and I mean, I could just off the top of my head start rattling off enough to go show after show after show. And man, maybe that becomes like a weekly thing. Here's our female-driven film
of the
week. Film pick of the week.
Yep.
Right?
That's pretty funny.
But you'll remember, and maybe you're only remembering this now,
right,
that I texted you this question in hopes that you would prepare some titles from classic Hollywood.
I did not get that text.
Yes, you did. It was the exact same text that let you know that Goodbye to Language in 3D was playing for a few more days.
No, that was a single message. There wasn't a second thing on there.
I'm sure. Do you want to pause for a moment and think about this?
No, we'll go. I'll start rattling. I'll start going through my brain.
Well, where to begin? I mean, because I like going at this both from... I thought we could go at this from both the origins of cinema.
Right.
Because, you know, look, again, referencing an upcoming show that we're going to have where we talk about our all-time favorite funny women.
Right.
You know, a lot of films at the outset were female-driven. Women had power.
Huge
power in this business.
There's a lovely monument at the corner of La Brea and Hollywood that is a monument to the women. Dorothy Dandridge, topped with Marilyn Monroe, all of them there. Saying that these were the monuments,
the cornerstones
of the Hollywood industry, were these women who were the original stars in the big box office.
One, wasn't it one in each ethnicity too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Although there's more than four ethnicities, I don't know what I'm saying, but four different ethnicities.
Yes, exactly.
I want to put an end to the rumor that there are more than four ethnicities right now.
You're really limited.
When I was studying with Jack Parsons,
he told me there's four.
And Rocket Fuel, he told me there's four, and oddly enough, they form my pentagram.
Yeah,
I don't know. All right. Well, no, Marilyn's the fifth, and that's my pentagram.
Yeah, see, there you
okay.
Go.
So I thought that was interesting, and you know, we could start at the beginning. I could also throw out a bunch that we have spoken of that are from the last handful of years that may have slipped past some people's radars, but are nevertheless important in a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
And then maybe we could, at the end, hit some of our all-time favorites.
Fantastic. We're doing that this show, or
doing that this show, okay. Since I had sent you the email to prepare.
Okay, well, right off the top,
okay,
I would go Bette Davis, All About Eve. Now
that's not, again, origin. That's golden age, but all right. So is that one of your all-time favorites?
That's one of my all-time favorites. When I think female...
So we're skipping my strategy altogether, which was talk about some of the early films, of the recent films, then go to our favorites.
Then go to our favorites. Yeah, I'm going in reverse order.
Okay. Bette Davis. Well, there's a great place to start because Bette Davis drive a handful of classic movies.
Absolutely. And from early on, too. So she was never the ingenue, really, that took the back seat.
She did a lot of crappy movies. People forget this. When she was a huge star, they wanted her doing crappy movies. I mean, you know, she was in the first or the second version of The Maltese Falcon before The Maltese Falcon. I think it was Satan Met a Lady. She's not even the lead in it. You know, she's taking the back seat as like a femme fatale ingenue.
And this was the hard thing back when it was a studio system, is that you signed resigned yourself to the studio and you were a contract player. You got paid weekly. You went to classes.
She's the one that broke that,
and
right?
She was the one that broke that because she was being put into these projects that were thought demeaning and beneath her talent. And she started fighting, as did everybody. It was a wave going through in the entire Hollywood community. But yeah, the studio system really put a clamp on a lot of female-driven items because that's how, you know, they just put, we need ingenue to action star, you know, that kind of thing. It was sort of really formulaic back then.
And so All About Eve, yes, is...
Bette Davis and...
Ann Baxter.
Ann Baxter. And they are crazy.
Well, that's an interesting segue from... Clouds of Sils Mario, which is kind of All About Eve as if it was made by Ingmar Bergman.
Oh, see, now that's awesome.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, well, Ingmar Bergman then makes me think of Ingrid Bergman and all the movies that she did where she was...
We'll mention some of them.
Okay, let's
so
go.
You, for, so you, but Bette
I
Davis...
With Bette
Davis is a great place to start.
Right.
And, and as always with anything like this, when it is so overwhelming... If you see something you like, find out about the people that made it, mm-hmm. find out about the actor who starred in it, mm-hmm. and maybe explore what other titles that they did that seem interesting, or find out what other films influenced the making of that movie, because then that might lead you to something. Like, we just drew a connection from Bette Davis in 1950 to Ingmar Bergman in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and even into the 80s, to French cinema today.
Right.
And that can be done. And you'll see these things referenced in reviews from time to time. You know, Bette Davis had a big comeback when her movies started to play on television.
Yes.
And a new generation found her. And as a result, some new films got financed with her in them. And they were these kind of gothic... horror tales,
yes.
Like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane,
yes,
and Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte,
yes.
And it occurred to me that horror films are one genre that has often maintained a female-driven stance.
Right.
No, many horror films are not, but it's one where no one would ever say, oh, you can't have that,
yeah,
in this genre. It's female-driven. That what you're describing, yeah, is female-driven. No, horror has always accepted that.
Right, but it may be because also the thing that you fear is always against something vulnerable, and so women have a vulnerability often. That,
and also, though, a strength that
strength
gets explored, the strength
the
of protecting family.
Oh, yes, of course.
Right?
Like Cujo.
But I was thinking about that, how many recent vintages of horror films I've not only loved, but that have been award-winning, have been female-driven. I'm trying to think of the last kind of award-winning horror film that was male-driven, but... You know, but I can find ones where they're not only embraced by an audience, but they're embraced by critics and award groups as art. And
right.
And two that came to mind right away were Mulholland Drive, David Lynch,
yes, of course,
and Black Swan, Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan. I mean, a lot of people were stunned when I saw that at an industry screening to realize that they had been sitting in a horror film. You know, but it certainly is one.
It certainly
at the
is.
End.
Yeah.
You know, much like some earlier ones that are like that. So I'll talk about some more of those.
Okay.
But a recent horror film from last year, female-driven, that I think I talked about in the show, but I would certainly recommend to everyone, is The Babadook. From Australia, directed by Jennifer Kent. And I also like that a lot of these female-driven films are made by female filmmakers. So you're also supporting female voices behind the camera as well. It stars Essie Davis as a troubled widow who discovers that her son is telling the truth about a monster that entered their home through the pages of a children's book. And it ultimately is a movie that talks about the importance of being nurturing towards everything.
Right.
Not just that which behaves itself.
Oh, gotta nurture that which you fear.
So you go from Bette Davis to what, Dean Haglund?
Then I'm thinking of, now you're taking me back to Silent Era.
Okay.
And
Well, you had said Ingrid Bergman. Did something come to mind to you about Ingrid Bergman?
Well, yeah, her early. Oh, now you got me. What was her breakthrough Swedish film? That now I have to dig.
Oh, you mean when she left America?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean when she left America?
Yeah. No.
And when she married Rossellini, or no?
No, before she married Rossellini, there was one that her breakout film.
Do we pause? Do we edit? No. Do you look it up?
I'll look it up. I'll look it up while you talk. And it was pre Casablanca, but
I also like how more and more, as you described on this show several times, science fiction and action
definitely
have become you know, female driven. I feel like maybe the action driven, you know, the female driven action film might have actually begun in science fiction, because that's a way you could get away with that idea.
Absolutely. You think of Aliens and Ripley with Sigourney Weaver.
So, and then flash forward to last year when Under the Skin comes out.
Yes.
From the UK. It made my top 10 list for the year, directed by Jonathan Glazer, and it stars Scarlett Johansson, who is an alien disguising herself as a human. And she goes on the run when she decides to break free from her mission to kill. I won't say more about what her mission is, because it's a big part of the mystery. But she becomes the hunted, and it's this fascinating exploration of what it means to be human while we focus entirely on an alien.
Wow. Now, speaking of which, that Ex Machina, well,
which just came out. Here's one, but I don't think that's female driven.
You don't think so?
No, in fact, I've heard that it has a real female problem. It has a fembot problem, is what I've heard. It's supposed to be a very good movie, but it's supposed to have a fembot problem.
Right.
In terms of its feminism. I'm hoping this discussion is helping anyone who's interested, since we're kind of rambling our way through it. But you know, another action film that was female driven that I admired, and I told you that if I had a daughter, I would show this film to her, was Zero Dark Thirty from Catherine Bigelow, another female filmmaker who made the great action film, The Hurt Locker.
Right.
This one starred Jessica Chastain as the woman who hunted down Osama bin Laden. However, not a perfect film, because hewing to the actual narrative of this woman, she's almost absent for the third act, which is getting him.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
But still, it's this you know, true to life story about the woman who hunted him down.
And that reminds me of my one that I always have championed, even though you are correct in saying that it is only two acts, is Salt with
Angelina Jolie.
Angelina Jolie, and to me, that's one where she is. It's got a great premise, and then there's tons of action. But you're right. It just stops waiting for a sequel to pick up.
And where is that?
I don't know.
Sequel. It was a hit.
It was a hit.
And people liked it.
Yeah.
So where is the Salt sequel? Absolutely. So that might be both a recommendation and a caution, that just as I hesitate to get started on TV shows until I know that they last long enough to resolve the story that they wanted to tell.
Yeah, right.
Maybe you want to hold off on something like that. I'm going to go into the other direction, which is some of the independent films that have really, nevertheless, not only received great acclaim, not the least of which is making my top 10 lists over the last several years, but also really launched a major career, either revivals or renaissance, for the women who were the leads.
Right.
And listen to some of these. How about Winter's Bone from 2010, again, directed by Deborah Granick, which starred Jennifer Lawrence.
That's
a lot of Jennifer Lawrence, you know, those Hunger Game movies are kind of female-driven.
Yes.
I don't know if you're aware of that.
I was not actually aware of that.
But this one is what established Jennifer Lawrence, and she's so good right out of the box. I miss her doing movies like this, where it was such a specific time and place, and you believed you were seeing the location and the real people. Faced with an unresponsive mother and a criminal father, a teenager in the Ozarks named Ree Dolly, played by Jennifer Lawrence, does what she can to manage the household and take care of her two younger siblings. When she's informed by the sheriff, the wonderful character actor Garrett Dillahunt, that their father put their home up for bond and then disappeared. So she and her little siblings are now going to lose the house. She has to set out on a dangerous quest to find him so that they can keep their home. And her entire family's fate is now in her teenaged hands. And she has to challenge all her outlaw kin's codes of behavior and silence and risk her life to learn what happened to her father in order to try to save the home. And it's so fascinating. You see a part of the world you don't know, but it's also just so tense.
Yeah.
And it really feels like, you know, it's the real deal.
Yeah. One that comes to mind is, and I'm trying to find that actress name, that Joan of Arc, the silent Joan of Arc from France. Do you remember this one?
Oh, yes. I had to, Jeanne d'Arc.
Jeanne d'Arc. And it's a silent film, and it's actually taken from the transcripts of the actual Joan of Arc trial. So there's no battle sequences. It's just the actress being accused by this room full of cardinals over and over again about does she speak to God? Is she hallucinating? Yes, the Passion of Joan of
Arc, yeah. Based on the actual trial transcripts.
Yeah, so they don't actually do anything other than just...
Carl Theodore Dreyer was the filmmaker.
Right, and the actress...
Renee Falconetti.
Who shaved her head, and basically it's close-ups of her deeply impassioned, holding her own against this tribunal that's out to burn her at the stake. And then, of course, the final footage of her being actually burned at the stake is harrowing. Unbelievable, considering there was no special effects back then. And the crowd that turns against the cardinals, it's all of it is a miracle of filmmaking, and one to see for a single acting role, a female driven.
How about this for a segue? You go silent film about a woman who is on trial because of her belief that she's communicating with God.
Mm-hmm.
I go with a woman who has to escape from a Jesus cult, Martha Marcy May Marlene. From 2011, directed by Sean Durkin, starring Elizabeth Olsen and Sarah Paulson, and also starring as the cult's manipulative leader, who, John Hawks, who would play Jennifer Lawrence's uncle in Winter's Bone.
That's awesome.
He's often the male presence in female-driven films, John Hawks. It's fascinating. Kind of the way, in a different way, but how Dabney Coleman, decades ago, used to always be kind of the bad guy in right. female-driven films. Because there's a way of reading Tootsie that's female-driven. But you know, but anyway,
well,
the story, after several years of living with a cult, Martha, played by Elizabeth Olsen, finally escapes, has to call her estranged sister Lucy, played by the fantastic Sarah Paulson, for help. Martha finds herself at the quiet Connecticut home Lucy shares with her new husband, but the memories of what she experienced in the cult make peace hard to find. And as flashbacks continue to torment her, Martha fails to shake her terrible sense of dread, especially in regard to the cult leader.
Right.
So hopefully that intrigues someone a little bit. These are really, really good. And if I remember correctly, Martha Marcy May Marlene, no music, which is terrific. There were a bunch of independent films at that time that eschewed music.
Yeah, remember
and,
that?
And it was such a good call. Another one of these, which really helped launch this young lady's career to another level, was Wendy and Lucy from director Kelly Reichardt, 2008, made my top 10 list, starring Michelle Williams.
Oh, yeah.
As a near penniless drifter who's traveling to Alaska in search of work, her only companion is her dog, Lucy. Already perilously close to losing everything, Wendy hits a big bump in the road when her car breaks down and she gets arrested for shoplifting dog food. Not her food for herself, for her dog. And when she posts bail and returns to retrieve Lucy, she finds that the dog's been taken. And that prompts a movie-long frantic search for the pet.
Aww.
And it's such a painful, harrowing look at people on the wrong side of the economic times.
Wow.
And that it's Michelle Williams.
I mean,
wow. So powerful.
So powerful. Well, you know, we talked about silent film stars and the It Girl, Claire Bow, came up in one of our conversations, perhaps in the future. But Clara Bow was a big comedy star, came up with the, and was known as the It Girl because of her magnetic personality that just drew
your
eye.
She's got it.
She's got it. And she did a comedy that I saw recently that is female-driven with another actress, Marie Prevost, called Kiss Me Again, where it's a hilarious merry mix-up in marriage and guys, and it's sort of a silent comedy, but there it's actually from the female's perspective, which is rare to see in silent comedy. So if you're looking for a silent comedy with a female driven, look up Kiss Me Again, 1925.
How are we doing on time?
We're doing pretty excellent, I must say.
Because I haven't even gotten to my top five yet.
Oh, okay, well, then let's hit them.
Well, in 2008, which was a great year, not only Wendy and Lucy, but two others that made my top 10 list that year, Frozen River, really launched television star Melissa Leo into movie star status.
Right.
She got an Oscar nomination for that. And Misty Upham. And who would get an independent film, independent spirit nomination, and then of course died this past year.
Right.
But anyway, Frozen River, an amazing, again, really tense, really exciting, and very authentic look at people on the wrong side of the economic times. But it's a movie about smuggling and crime over the border into Canada.
Right.
And it's very exciting and completely female driven. And another film from 2008 starring the fantastic Kristin Scott Thomas working in French, as she always seems to be doing when she gets her best roles. because she's a British actress, but her best roles are always in French films.
Yeah.
In I've Loved You So Long, she plays a woman who's let out of prison after 15 years. For killing her own son. And she tries to reconnect with her sister, Leia, after years of estrangement. And it's a really fascinating mystery film. And again, I've now mentioned a couple films that not only are female-driven, but are driven by sister relationships.
Right. Isn't that funny?
But I was thinking about this, that, you know, it's almost like we could do a show where if someone named us the genre, because we did this whole show about funny ladies because, you know, just remembering how upset we were when people said that Bridesmaids was the show, the movie that proved that women could be funny.
Right.
So we decided to do a whole show about women who proved that women could be funny, which didn't need to be proven because we all know funny women.
Right. But, the last 100 years.
But we could almost do a whole show where if somebody said, Dean and Phil, name female-driven comedies. We could do that.
We could do that.
And what I would say...
Which one do you go to?
Well, I was thinking of the decade of the 80s was a really good decade for comedies about women in the workplace. If you're interested in that...
Working Girl?
Working Girl, very good. Mike Nichols.
Yeah.
And 9 to 5, Colin Higgins.
Oh, yeah. Dolly Parton and Jane Fonda.
Well, what if said female-driven thrillers? Well, we've already named some, but how about beginning with Thelma and Louise?
Thelma and Louise. I was just going to say that.
From Ridley Scott.
I would call that a comedy, though. Did you call that a thriller?
I would call it a thriller,
really?
Yeah.
I laughed a lot at that, actually.
But it could be a comedic thriller.
My favorite is, okay, hang up if you know anything's wrong when you're talking to your husband on the phone.
But like a buddy, or a buddy road picture
might be more
appropriate because you always think dudes.
Yeah. And who did that career launch? Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt, it sure did.
Oh, that was a great cameo.
And you already mentioned, you know, we could do action with aliens. But but here's my top five going in reverse chronological order, starting most recent.
Okay.
2001, Amelie. From director Jean-Pierre Jeunet, made my best of the decade list, starring Audrey Tautou, made her an international star.
So good.
Amelie is a fanciful comedy about a young woman who discreetly orchestrates the lives of the people around her, creating a world exclusively of her own making.
Yep.
And it's so romantic and so funny.
An early work of CGI where they erased the graffiti in the cars of Paris.
Yeah.
So Paris was this magical place of free of traffic and dirt
And they could therefore shoot in all the actual locations.
All the actual locations and make it just so romantic. And weird metaphors, like where she falls in love and just turns to water, like just a gush of water in that one scene. There were so many great CGI moments that were almost invisible.
And it explores so many different relationships she has. It's not just trying to get a guy. In fact, she's trying not to get a guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Is the whole thing.
Right.
You know, she's trying to just make a difference in all these different people's lives.
Yeah. So good.
1974. I'm going all the way back to 1974. But we're, if I'm only doing all-time top five...
You got
to
go there.
And it's fun saying this one because last night I actually watched a really underrated Woody Allen film from 1988 called Another Woman. And it was a drama, one of his Bergman-esque dramas,
right.
80 minutes long. He gets in, he gets out,
Bing.
Tells a cool story, and it starred Jenna Rollins. And it was so much fun because Woody in the late 80s was actually a great director.
Yeah.
He really was a great director.
He was really... efficient.
And of course he would want to work with Jenna Rollins, whose best film and one of my all-time favorites and one of my top five here, female-driven films, A Woman Under the Influence.
Of course.
Directed by her husband, John Cassavetes.
Uh-huh.
Jenna Rollins is desperate and lonely, married to a Los Angeles municipal construction worker. Mm-hmm. Nick, played by Peter Falk.
Peter Falk, so
also
good.
Also good in it. And if all you know him from is Columbo, you know, see that. It's incredible.
Yeah. Blow your mind.
Increasingly unstable, especially in the company of others, she craves happiness, but her extremely volatile behavior convinces Nick that she poses a danger to their family, and he decides to commit her to an institution for 6 months. And it's really interesting because it's called A Woman Under the Influence, but at no time do you ever get to see her drink or take drugs or doing anything like
right.
this. It's really the effect that people in real life have a lot of times, which is, you know, when someone seems to be behaving a certain way, but you can't prove that they're on something,
yes.
you know,
because sure.
it's hidden. So much of it is hidden.
Yeah.
It's a great, great movie.
Absolutely.
Should I keep going?
Yes, please do.
Mentioned horror.
Left.
Mentioned horror, mentioned Babadook, mentioned this, you know, these female-driven horror films. I'm going to say that the best of all of them, and that there's a lot of great
there's
ones,
a lot
man,
to choose from.
But I'm going to go with Repulsion. 1965, directed by Roman Polanski, starring Catherine Deneuve.
Of course.
It was Polanski's first English language film. Catherine Deneuve plays a young manicurist who suffers from the pathological fear of interaction with men. Look it up. That's a real thing. Androphobia. Pathological fear of interaction with men. When her sister, again, sister relationship, and roommate Helen leaves their London flat to go on an Italian holiday with her married boyfriend, Carol withdraws into her apartment and soon begins to experience frightful hallucinations as her fear gradually mutates into madness.
Wow. You know, I don't think I've ever seen that fully.
Oh, it still scares the Jesus out of me.
I'm going to have to check it out.
Two left.
Yep.
1957, another star who was married to her director and did fantastic work when they collaborated, The Knights of Cabiria.
Oh, yes.
1957.
So great.
The fantastic Giulietta Masino, one of the greatest comedians of all time, who would get very excited because Fellini would never start a script. He would start doodling images that had come to mind, and then he would do the script. And if she noticed that he just did a very tight, perfect circle, he knew that she had a part in it. She would always be happy because that was how he began to always draw her face, was with a tight perfect circle.
Because she had such a round face.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
She plays in The Knights of Cabiria an eternally optimistic Rome streetwalker with a heart of gold. I mean, this is where we kind of get the
that
hooker
trope,
with a
yeah.
heart of gold trope. And a head full of cotton candy. and it was an Oscar-winning film for foreign language film. It's funny, it's poignant, and it inspired the musical Sweet Charity. So it's a must-see for all Fellini fans. But also, I mean, she really was, you know, as we talk about in a later show, she was... it wasn't silent, but international cinema obviously relied on telling stories visually,
right.
expressing the things in nonverbal ways. And she
as
was so good at this.
Yeah.
And as a result, was often compared to being Italy's Harpo Marx. And it's a really apt comparison.
I can totally see that.
Finally, for me, because I do not know the silence as I should.
Right.
So for me, where kind of proto-feminist cinema begins is The Women, 1939.
Of course.
Directed by George Cukor, starring an all-star cast. And when we say all-star cast, we mean every box office draw of the 30s and every woman who was about to become the biggest box office draws of the 40s.
Right.
Norma Shearer, Joan Crawford, Rosalind Russell, Mary Boland, Paulette Goddard.
Yes.
Anyway, it was remade as a horrible, horrible movie.
Remember
a few
that?
Years ago.
Yeah.
I don't want to. Ignore that.
Ignore but, that. See the 1939.
See the 1939 movie. It holds up really well. It's very funny.
Yeah.
And
socialites. I mean, they're all a variety of different women that all come together. And I know for a fact that part of the marketing plan for that was to put an exclamation mark on the other side, on your marquee, was to make it not just women, but women! so that would be the draw to get everybody into the theater.
Ah, well, Agent Summer, I hope that helps. I hope that gives some people some fun hours of exploration and viewing.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed getting that question. That brings an end to another exciting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
You can hear, you can't really see them, but you can hear so many episodes at our website.
Put up a mirror and see yourself enjoying so right. many episodes at chillpackhollywood.com. Thanks to our friends at Blog Talk Radio, almost all our shows we've ever done are in fact available again.
Isn't that something?
Less than 25 still to go.
Holy smokes.
Anyway, our website is chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com.
You can find us on Stitcher. You can hear us at iTunes. You can even write a review.
What could be more fun? Like us, please, on Facebook.
Yes, at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
And follow us on Twitter.
We are at Dean and Phil.
Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
And I'm Dean Haglin. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.